The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Hi, Joe.
Charlotte, hello. I think we're both in a mild state of overwrought, but not in a bad way of work tiredness. But sometimes that can be a source of inspiration. I'm very curious. What have you been reading lately?
I feel like I'm in a little bit of a reading slump. I'm reading books that are good, but they're not super propulsive. A lot of them are kind of research. I'm reading this book about plants of the Bible, which is legitimately very interesting, but it's not exactly like, ooh, I can't wait to plop down with this.
That book sounds great. Every semester that I teach, I always end up explaining prosopopoeia, you know, like when things talk, like the burning bush when it has a conversation in the Bible. So I've always wanted to read something that was more widely about speaking plants, and if there are any others.
Well, as well to say, the book I am going to talk about today is completely removed, but the book I want to talk about with you actually is very concerned with Catholicism, so in some ways it's not that far removed from the Bible. But the book I finished last night, was Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. Have you read it?
No, I've never read that. I think The End of the Affair is and Travels with My Aunt. I mean, those are the Graham Greene books that I like know well. No, I've never read Brighton Rock.
Brighton Rock is mentioned at the beginning of Susanna Moore's In the Cut, which we discussed a few episodes ago. She mentions the narrator in the cut, Franny, who is a teacher, is talking about books she thinks about assigning to her students, and she wants to see how they would react to Brighton Rock, but she is given pause by recalling a passage. She says a dream. It's something, her line is something like, it's a dream in which the murderer is holding a blade and thinks, quote, such tits. And I hesitate to say this, and perhaps we will cut it out. That is a big piece of foreshadowing for In the Cut itself. But Brighton Rock had merged in my mind with the Ian McEwan book you mentioned when we talked to Tony in season one, and we were joking about it because you said On Chesil Beach, and then you're like, no, that's the name of a different book. Do you recall this part of our conversation?
Completely. And Ian McEwan, right? The guy who wrote Atonement. All his novels really fused together in my mind because that is also the book where it turns out to be 9/11, I think.
I am far from an Ian McEwan expert. I have read like Black Dogs and The Cement Garden, and I've read the first half of Atonement, I think like 3 times now, and I never get past the first half. And I was looking up, after I finished Brighton Rock, I was looking up Chesil Beach, or On Chesil Beach, I forget what it's called, but and reading it, I'm just like, oh yeah, Ian McEwan's whole deal is sort of like, what if you were you know, white and middle class, and something fucked up happened. Like, right? Isn't that kind of his whole deal?
Well, let me see. Yeah, well, what if you were white and British and middle class and sexually repressed, but some sexual mistake for which everyone was actually blameless has ruined your life because of your overactive guilt glands?
Well, he seems a little like in a slightly different life, he would have just been someone obsessed with, he would have been a woman obsessed with true crime. Like Cement Garden, there's like incest and the parents die or something, right? And then in his second novel, it's this couple on vacation and they get like drugged and murdered or something. And then the part I remembered from your conversation with me and Tony was that there was some murderer who made a girl get pregnant and then she recited poetry or something. So anyway,
that is not what happened. What I remember is a guy breaks into the house. He makes the family sit down. He forces the daughter to strip off her clothes. And then it turns out she's pregnant. And then she recites all of On Dover Beach from memory. And he's like, oh my God, that poem's so good. I'm not going to rob you anymore.
Right. But why did she have to be naked for the robbery? He was just sort of like, wow, we're at it.
Yeah, I think so. But I don't trust my recollection of this novel at all.
Well, I did skim the Wikipedia entry because I was trying to sort out this mess in my mind, right? Of Britishness, beaches, white male authors, novels, like women who are naked and boobs and breasts and tits and blades and like trying to work it out. So... Brighton Rock is about, apparently, first of all, it's a sequel, sort of, which I didn't know, but that's okay. You can read it standalone. I did. About this, his name is Pinky, but he's also called the boy. And he's a 17-year-old who is a sadist and a murderer. And he's part of a small-time mob that's sort of warring with the big-time mob in Brighton Beach, and his associates carry out a murder, and they do it sloppily, and so the book is him trying to cover it up, and of course the cover up just necessitates ever escalating levels of cover up, and it's not a funny book, but I did find it very funny that he gets to a point where he's just constantly thinking, he's like, do I have to murder every single person in the entire world to get away with this? And the answer is basically yes, which is not doable. And so it's sort of a crime drama. There's a detective element because this civilian woman is on the case. She's convinced this man was murdered and she wants to know who did it. Pinky is taking advantage of this girl, but who's very poor and who is starting to piece together that Pinky was responsible for this murder. She's gleaning dangerous things, so he convinces her to marry him because you can't force a wife to give evidence against a husband. And it's a messy novel. Clearly my brain was messy while I was reading it as well, but it's not an especially polished work. It's kind of heavy-handed as well. There's a lot of talk about good and evil and mortal sin and being damned and right and wrong, and characters will essentially give the one detective figure, her name's Ida, and she repeatedly gives these little speeches, these little soliloquies where she's like, I believe in what's right and wrong, and people have to do what's right. And so it's, even though I think it was his ninth novel, he was still learning how to write novels, which is kind of nice to read. You know, I don't know, like, that's nice. Like, that's how writers learn to do things, is by doing them and hopefully getting better or more refined or more interesting as you go. But can I read you an example of the prose?
Please.
So this was just I just liked this paragraph about Pinky. The boy licked an indelible pencil. His mouth was stained purple at the corners. The envelope addressed Mr. J. Tate lay on the washstand, the corner soiled with coffee. When he had finished writing, he put his head back on the pillow and closed his eyes. He fell asleep at once. It was like the falling of a shutter, the pressure of the bulb which ends a time exposure. He had no dreams. His sleep was functional. When Dallow opened the door, he woke at once. "Well," he said, lying there without moving, fully dressed among the pastry crumbs. I really liked that passage for characterization of Pinky, who is a 17-year-old madman. And kind of like an abused dog, like a nasty dog.
You know, one thing that I remember about Graham Greene is that he was defensive about the idea that he put, like, especially gross human behavior or, like, people in his books, and that he would be like, people are just like this, which I think is sort of true. I don't know. I mean, because that all does feel very quite real, quite psychological.
I think so, and I think he does it convincingly. There's also a passage that I liked a lot where Pinky goes to ask Rose's parents to let her marry him because she's 16, she's too young to do it without their permission. And he's being reminded he grew up in the area she grew up in, which is like a very squalid, debased place without kindness. And he's looking at some kids and remembering his own childhood, and he sort of thinks something like, yeah, back when there was innocence. And then he said, no, but innocence, you have to go back a lot further than that. You have to go back to a baby. And then he said, maybe you have to go even further back to, like, the very instant you're born. And that's some people's lives, you know, like not an insignificant number of people live like very hard, loveless lives. And it makes sense that a person like Pinky could be the product of that, I thought.
Charlotte, have you ever seen the film that they made about the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster?
No, I doubt it. I've seen like 5 movies, and you already know that one of them is Antichrist.
I love this. I love that Antichrist is one of our like art.
I know. Our touchstones, Lanark and Antichrist. Yeah.
There are more, but the Deepwater Horizon movie stars Mark Wahlberg, and he's not bad in it, but I just kind of got stuck on this. And then I was like watching a lot of like engineering disaster movies just sort of like for obvious reasons. Like I watched the 33, which is a film about the Chilean miners, you know, who got trapped underground.
Yes,
which incredibly had Juliette Binoche in it playing the older sister of one of the miners. And the main head miner was played by Antonio Banderas. Anyway, this is beside the point, except that it would be cool if you were, you know, an oil rig worker who had this really shitty thing happen to them. And then you're like, and now Mark Wahlberg is playing you. This is all to say that this is why I picked up a short book that's from the Field Notes series. Which I don't really know, honestly, but it's sort of like mini little folios, like pocket-sized thingamies. And by a guy named Don Gilmore, who worked as a roughneck, which is an amazing name for a job, on oil rigs, but in Alberta, in Canada, in the 70s. And I guess I didn't know anything about Alberta's oil boom and deregulation in that region in the 70s and 80s. Essentially, I'm just fascinated at the moment with oil rigs and what it's like to work on them. I can't seem to understand exactly how much mud you're supposed to encounter, because like in the Deepwater Horizon film there's a lot of mud, but I can't tell, there hasn't been that much mud in what he's written about, but there is some really great writing just about being near huge machines, which is in itself fascinating. And then so some of this, but the book as a whole obviously kind of extends into a history of oil industry in North America, but specifically in Canada. It also has this amazing quote, which I had no idea that Ronald Reagan had said. I had never heard this, but is this known to you that Ronald Reagan once said... It's so stupid that I like cannot, kind of can't believe it, but I definitely believe that it's true. Reagan famously remarked that trees cause more pollution than automobiles do.
I think I have heard that before, but I don't know if I... It's good trivia, for sure.
For God's sake. Well, you know, super interesting stuff, but I mostly... I like the like vivid writing about being on an oil rig. Like, that's just cool as hell. Machinery writing, just kind of intrigued by at the moment. The meaning of oil rigs, the look of oil rigs, the things that people film from oil rigs, like feeding sharks. There's also the other thing I wanted to briefly touch on is there's a short section, sorry, it's a very different topic, of Umberto Eco's book The Open Work, which is a very fun, like breezy work of literary theory, but a lot of it is about like medieval literary history and manuscripts and stuff, which is nice. But there's a section on it in it called Meaning and Information in the Poetic Message, where he has just some like really well articulated little points, and he starts with this really great observation about how he's like, the thing with poetry is that it always seems more meaningful the less it sounds like normal words. So it's a kind of issue of probability. Like, you know how like LLMs basically, and generative AI works on this basis of probability, like what is the likelihood that the next word will be X or whatever. But obviously he's not referring to that, but he's saying if you calculate internal probability within a language, like the less ordered something is, the more poetic it would be. But then he's saying it's not just the same thing as entropy, because meaning is not really the same as information. It's a really solid little kernel of logic that leads to some really nice observations about meaning. And I was just reflecting on how Umberto Eco is just a really great writer and a great non-fiction writer. Obviously he has the like silly novels, which are fun, but The Open Work is something that I've really taken for granted in the past, because it's sort of this book that does a lot of explaining why medieval texts are sort of theoretically interesting, and mostly in the fact that they're unstable. You know, like they, from each manuscript to manuscript, a text will completely vary, and so it really like questions the definition of a text. You know, like, is a text a particular string of words? Because it's not that. Is it by a particular author? Because, like, we don't know that. So he strings together a lot of really interesting stuff, but it's specifically, I guess, about the instability that, like, it's sort of about unfixing meaning is sort of, like, the key to, or the fact that meaning has been unfixed in some way is like a key to understanding what meaning is. And I just think it's really worth a reread, and I'm gonna go on a little like respect Umberto Eco again tour.
You came to the right place to announce the launch of this tour too, which I really appreciate. I appreciate you giving reading writers the scoop.
It's a journey of appreciation. It's I just thought his musings on probability and the difference between meaning and information in the context of linguistic probability was shockingly relevant to our informational problems of our time.
I just read a paper from, I think it was like before World War II, talking about art, and it feels like somebody could have written this today about AI. And we're nearing the end of our season, and all of our threads or all of our chickens are coming home to roost. All of our idea chickens are coming home. And we've been talking about Virgil and Dante and the Bible, all this stuff. Everything old is new again, and everything new is old as hell. We're joined today by Rain Fisher Kwan, who is a Brooklyn-based writer. Her blog is called Internet Princess, and her first book, Complex Female Character, is forthcoming from Knopf. When, though, Rain?
Oh, that's such a great question. I'm almost done. If all goes well, then I will.
Well done.
In the next couple months. Thank you. It's so, such a hard
Congratulations.
Thing to do. Thank you. I mean, congratulate me when I've done it. I have some unanswered texts from my editor right now as we speak. So, but yeah, I'm chugging along. I'm hoping 2027 that book will be out in the world.
It will be.
That's
I
so
bet.
Fantastic.
I think so. Yes.
Charlotte has published many books. I have never finished writing a single book ever. So you're doing incredible.
I know, it's so amazing, so Charlotte. I'm like so. I mean, I say this all the time now. Where like now that I've started. To try to do this, that like I've obviously been an appreciator of books for a while, but I now that I know how difficult it is, I always think whenever I read like a pan of a book or like a sort of negative review, I always think that like every review should start with one sentence that's just like, to be fair, it is really hard to write a book, and then you can say whatever you want.
Yeah,
it's super hard.
I've just wrote this review for Bookform about Daniel Bergen, who wrote. Over 50 books. That's a little bit fudged maybe because some of his books were conversations. But I've always been like, I wish I could pick one. I should feel like I should have one to tell people when they say, what should I read? If I say, this is the one. And I don't think it exists. And I've been thinking about it a lot. I don't think he ever wrote a truly great book, but that isn't an insult. It's just writing a great book is a miracle. And I don't even think it's down to the writer. But it feels like so many things have to fall into place for a truly great book to exist. No, or even just like serendipity. The things that have to line up for a truly great book to come into being.
Everything has to fall. It's like a movie. My boyfriend is a filmmaker, and I never appreciated before being with him like how much of a complete miracle it is for any movie to be made, and how it is like 100 different miracles have to happen in order for one good movie to be made. And I think it, like, so much of a great book is, like, contextual. It's, like, the things that happen in the world when it's coming out, like, the, like, things. Yeah. And I was just talking with somebody about how being, like, a completionist for an author's work is so humanizing, because, like, when you read everything that an author has done, even, like, a genius, you're kind of like, oh, like, even a genius, probably half of these books are not that good. And I still think she's a genius and that almost all of them were nearly perfect. But my favorite writer ever is Vivian Gornick. And I've read more of her work than I've read of any other author's work. And it just was like, by the time I'd read like her sixth book or like the seventh book of hers that I had read, it was very just like humanizing where I was like, oh, like you know, just like anybody, like there's certain turns of phrase that you use again and again. There's like certain, you pull the same material. And it did, like, I think sometimes you can think of a book or like of like a great writer as being like so untouchable or so like inconceivable, but
Vivian is just a girl too, you know, living for the first time.
She's spectacular, but I feel like she was the first incredible author I read enough of to encounter exactly what you're describing, Rain, where I was realizing, oh, she like self-plagiarizes huge chunks sometimes. And I respect it so much because
respect inherently saying, I said it right the first time. I'm happy to say it again, but I did say it right the first time. So here you go. It's relevant. I'm going to put it in here.
It is. There's so much of Odd Woman in the City that is like taken directly from Approaching Eye Level. And
yeah,
I would read it and I was like, I can't knock you. Like, you did say it perfectly the first time. And it is also interesting because I think she recontextualizes some stories that she told at the time and, like, tells them in a different way or with different details. And it, like, definitely rewards that type of thing. But it was also, like, very humanizing, too. Yeah, she's my complete goat. I love her so much.
I have a feeling you're not here to talk about Vivian Gornick officially.
Well, yeah. I was thinking of doing Approaching Eye Level, but then I thought that I really wanted to do After Claude.
Nice.
Has anyone done that book on here before?
No, but it has come up. Do you remember, Joe? Because I was talking about, when I was talking about female dirtbags. It might have been in the Nettie Jones like conversation. I can't wait to hear your take on this book.
I've never read it. Have you read it, Charlotte?
Mm-hmm.
I love it when this happens. This is great.
Well, what do you think about it, Charlotte? Do you want to go first a little bit?
No, absolutely not. I want you to tell us everything about it. Yeah.
Well, I read this book. Basically, this book is about a woman named Harriet, and it's by Iris Owens, who was like a very, there's like not that much about her on the internet. After I read this book, I became so obsessed with her and I wanted to learn everything about her. And there's not a ton of material about her, but she was basically like this sort of like, I don't know, she's very similar to the character in that she seemed to have been like a real difficult person to be around. And she wrote for Olympia Press, I think it was called, which was like the famous erotica press. And she wrote a lot of like erotic pornographic novels under the pseudonym Harriet. And then she wrote this book under her own name, like her first novel, After Claude. And the main character is named Harriet, which adds this sort of like interesting auto-fictional element to the whole thing. And I'm so interested in her. All the things that I've read said about her are like totally fascinating to me. She was like, Samuel Beckett had been kind of in love with her, and she had this like long string of like luminaries who she had affairs with and who then like never wanted to speak to her ever again. And she wrote this book, which is about a woman in the 70s in New York who is like visibly a brilliant woman and who's like incredibly sharp and acerbic and critical, but who, well, in the introduction to the book in this edition, Emily Prager says that the book is fundamentally about the lengths that intelligent women will go to not use their intelligence, which I mean I read when I just the introduction, I think this edition has a great introduction, and I cried reading the introduction alone. It like really affected me or like hit something in me. And there's also something in the introduction about how basically like at the time they had felt like feminists had like not, that there was no room in feminist culture for a discussion of like intelligent women putting themselves into like submissive poses on purpose, like because of the humor that the situation would like sort of develop, or like that intelligent women would put themselves into these like masochistic submissive positions and then only humor can get them out of it and stuff like that. And that really is what the book is about. It's like a extremely funny book to me. Every line I laughed so much. I think her first spoken line in the book is they're watching what's that movie called? It's like the 60s movie, like this about Saint Michael. It's a movie about the crucifixion, and she's watching with her boyfriend Claude, who is sort of the first line of the book is, I left Claude the French rat, and she hates Claude, but she's also she hates Claude, and she's completely like, the entire book is her eviscerating him, but she also like can't live without him. And the whole book is sort of this tension. Most of the book is this tension of her sort of privately narrativizing everything that she hates about him, and then also like begging him not to leave her. And all this to say that her first spoken line in the book while they're watching this movie, this realist movie about the crucifixion, is after Christ is killed, she says, thank God I thought that F slur would never die. And it's like on the third page, and I like laughed out loud. And I just thought, this, I like this lady. It's really funny. And I don't want to give too much of this plot synopsis, but it's mostly character study. And then at the very end of the book, it takes a very sort of sharp turn. And suddenly she's living in the Chelsea Hotel, and she encounters a group of sort of cultists, like kind of like free love, misogynist, culty characters. And the book takes a very dark tonal turn that complete... I've met people who really hate the ending, and I loved the ending. And I thought that it described something for me that in better terms than I had ever seen it described before, about the ways that, like, women's intelligence can sometimes be, like, used against them, or how, like, thinking that you're in control of everything because you're able to make fun of it, or, like, to sneer at it or roll your eyes at it, can actually sometimes keep you in the submissive position, or, like, keep you made a fool of, which is something that I've experienced myself, certainly. And it's also a very, like, it has a lot of that, like, 70s, very vulgar, like, 70s racism in a very sort of upsetting way and all that stuff. It's, like, definitely not a perfect book, but I just couldn't, it, like, changed the way I talked after I read it. Like, I just, like, wanted to live in that character. Yeah. What did you think about it, Charlotte?
I read it a long time ago. I remember really enjoying it, feeling impressed by it. I think for the same reasons you're describing. Rain, have you ever read Heather Lewis's Notice? They're Lewis, like, and
least,
Iris.
The least sexy lesbian novel of all time.
It's one of the sexiest novels about a lesbian fucking an evil, like a literally sadistic evil man of all time. Of all time, and then having lesbian sex. That's awful. Because Heather Lewis was a lesbian who wrote this book about how incredibly threatening sex with a man is compelling and can be something that even if you think your life is in danger, you keep exposing yourself to. And it's not to imply that this is also what After Claude is about at all. But I think it was just something about, like, oh, we actually have this legacy of women exploring this, but they're obscure.
I was just going to say, just quickly, I feel like I have to say it before we move on, that I think we would never have gotten there without the great epistolary sex writers of the internet age, most importantly being Charlotte Shane and many others whose work no longer exists or is accessible, but all kinds of the fucking blogs, right?
You're right that there were a profusion of them and they were super popular.
It was the same time that, like, only it was like I Love Dick stood in for trying to find genuinely like trying to find that tradition, but it's like, okay, Semiotext is maybe the only publisher that like got there in time. But this whole genre is, like, I mean, not to make it, I managed to make every conversation about this, but, like, in my work on the medieval mystics. But it, honestly, like, first-person writing by women in living in marginal circumstances has a theological background, a philosophical background, a creative, expressive, you know, written background, which has been deliberately erased.
Really? It's
sort of extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, this is so, like, offside, and there's a lot that I don't know about this, of course, but in my book, for years and years and years, like, probably the person that I've, like, felt the most intense emotional connection to, whose writing I've read, is Marjorie Kemp, and I love Marjorie Kemp. One of the essays in my book is about, like, me and Marjorie Kemp, and...
Oh my gosh.
We should talk about it. I love Marjorie Kemp. My boyfriend, when I was like 20, was studying medieval translation, and he like called me, kept coming home from class one day, and he was like, "Rain, in class, we found about a woman who's just like you."
That's such a compliment. Oh my God.
Rain, when I was your age, I tried to sell a book about Marjorie Kemp to complete disinterest. And I sold the book this summer. And I've been writing it the whole time, translating the book. So I cannot wait to talk to you so much more. I can't believe this. We're both talking about this extraordinarily unpopular woman who fucked constantly and wasn't that interested in the men. She's interested in herself and the theology of her desire, what it can do. But she never mentions any of the actual children, her actual like love interests, except as it relates to herself. And that book was, you know, it was essentially sabotaged in publication in the 1930s.
I love that lady. And now I even forget why I brought this up. But
I'm sorry, we're talking about the theological tradition of marginal women's writing. And Lewis is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And sexual obsession.
Yeah, sexual obsession. And just this, like, this combination of, like, that I find in this book, too, of, like, really honest writing about like sexual debasement and like sexual obsession and the like moving through that to a sense of self. And then also like the thing that I think is so present in Marjorie Kemp is this like totally unfounded, like societally unfounded belief that like your experience has mattered and that it deserves to be written about, which like obviously Marjorie Kemp is like, to me, the most extreme and radical example of that, because pretty much nobody had in the English language had ever written about their life before so directly. I feel like now it's like we should be talking about Marjorie Kemp, but in Robert Gluck, is it Gluck? In Robert Gluck's Marjorie Kemp, the line that I think is so beautiful in that is where he says, like, she replaced existence with the desire to exist. And I think about that line all the time. And I find so much of that in all these books about, like, the sort of pain and debasement of, like, loving men and of, like, sexual experiences with men. And that's so present in After Claude to me, too, is, like, this, like, real record of, like, a desire for your experience to have mattered and of, like, also all the awful things about you to have mattered. And I think what's so beautiful about this book is that obviously the character is like satirical and it's like sort of, I mean, she's drawn a lot of comparisons to like Philip Roth and like all this stuff. Like, it's a character that you're supposed to laugh at because she's completely ridiculous and you can understand why she's been like kicked out of every home she's ever lived in and why nobody can stand to be around her. And then you also like love her. And I totally loved her while I was reading it. And I thought that that was like a really fine line to walk. That really moved me.
There's something about like a completely irrational woman that is instantly relatable.
But then it's like you've just spliced together mine and Charlotte's intellectual worlds to show that they are in fact the same thing. No, it's that's like revelatory to me.
Oh my gosh! All my
labors alone with the manuscripts, you know. And I feel like, and Charlotte like being in the world,
it's all like, connected, surely.
Yeah, through Marjorie. I mean, any woman who is obdurate about her desire, however sort of unpleasant or monstrous she might be in one dimension, there's also just this. In my opinion, a complete uninterruptible affinity and appreciation for her on my end, where I might be like, oh yeah, you're awful. I don't really want to spend any time around you, but also keep doing your thing, girl. Like,
the strange thing is that what the taint of that sexual desire can do as well, because, you know, the Book of Marjorie Kemp is like the first memoir in English, as you say, but it's also like, it's the first record of a woman being interrogated for heresy. It's the first record of actually like quite a lot of different things. And it was sort of, and as T.S. Eliot expresses in that letter, it's like what he sees as pathological, which is this kind of like cluster B, you know, like the like borderline girly of the church or whatever, that has this infectious taint that like can't be permitted into the contemporary Christian church, because this is something that we identify as having completely different. Modernity like identifies as having completely different gender concepts, especially as it relates to the church. Like, because we've had, like, the Reformation, right? We had to cancel Catholicism to make a new religion where this stuff was a lot less up there, where there's a lot less talking about, like, vaginas of, you know, and hymens and, like, women martyrs who, like, had all their teeth pulled out, you know? Like, we had to take that stuff out. So it has to be deliberately stamped out when it comes back.
Yes, yeah, it has to come back, totally. And this is, like, why I'm so interested in Marjorie, is because so much of my, like, relationship with God, for me, it has been very difficult for me to, like, figure out where the line of, like, pathologization should lie, like, if I've been having sort of, like, mental health crises, or if, like, those are, you know, engagements with, you know, God that are legitimate in their own way. And yeah, I think that she is really amazing. And I also think something that's, so again, I'm not an expert in the manuscript or anything, but something that's so moving to me about a lot of her life is how, like, there are many times where, like, church officials and people really are, like, moved by her experiences genuinely, and that her, like, connection with God that I think now seems so, to at least the modern Catholic Church, so foreign and so pathological and so inadmissible, was, like, incredibly moving and meaningful to, like, many of the people at the time.
And rhetorically effective.
Yes.
Like, she got away. Like, she never was burned, and she came really close to being burned. And every time she gives a speech in the court about how... And these are the bits that people think are boring as well, right? Like, her big speeches. But she'll be like, I wasn't even preaching. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I was just talking about how much I love God, how hard everything is for me. And sometimes I cry about it, but that's just because I love God and, like, life is so hard. Like, boo-hoo, right? And sometimes it's true, and it's... exactly as you say, like, this unbelievable expression that people really react to.
Of course, and it's like, so what? Talk about how much you love this guy and cry over it all the time? Lock me up!
They're accusing her of preaching, which women aren't allowed to do, and she's like, I'm not preaching. If you're moved, that's nothing to do with me. I'm just living here. And it works. And the thing is that there's some really cool scholars in the field who have, like, cross-referenced everything that she says, and it turns out she's not actually making it up. She's, like, quoting all kinds of other writers who have written really serious, like, theological tracts, and that's, she makes them cry, and she's right, right? And she gets away every time, but she, you know, she couldn't read or write. Supposedly, we don't really know. But it's really unclear how in control she is and how in control other people think she is.
Totally. I feel like, again, to tie it back to everything, I feel like that's, I mean, such a theme that I find in so much sort of, like, again, like, debased women's writing or whatever, is, like, that, yeah, that there's often a lot more control than people are willing to give them credit for, and often that, like, these women do know what they're doing, and that there's, like, just an objective that isn't, like, I don't know, that sometimes the objective is to feel pain because that pain gives spiritual meaning or makes them feel like they exist, and, you know, and that maybe, like, obviously, I think when I'm reading this book, because this After Claude is, like, such a, I read it and so much of it strikes me as so completely of the modern, like, hetero-pessimist moment of, like, being so willing to trade in this, like, social currency of throwing all of these barbs out at the men who are treating you horribly and rolling your eyes at them and making fun of them so accurately, but still, like, completely tossing everything away in, like, desperation to, like, stay having access to this love and this attention. And even the language in the book that I think is so funny, it reads so much to me like a Twitter feed, where, like, a constant theme of the character is that every task to her is, like, completely insurmountable. Like, there's, like, just, like, totally randomly, there's, like, a second of a scene where she's, like, going to grab a kimono from her room to, like, put over her pajamas or whatever. And the paragraph is, like, somehow I managed to locate the hidden kimono in my absolute haystack of my sheet. Like, everything requires, like, unimaginable effort, and every tiny action is a victory in the sort of grand narrative of her life over this. And it's, like, so, like, really evokes, like, I'm just a girl, how can I pay my taxes in a way that's, like, so of the moment, which is obviously a thing that I'm critical of in both cases, but in this it reads like a satire of this thing that, like, didn't even exist yet.
Are you writing about After Claude at all, or do you feel like it informed your writing?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it. I mean, definitely, I've used it sparingly in some essays so far, like just like quotes. I used a quote from the introduction, or an anecdote from the introduction in a different piece. I've been like thinking for a while about an essay that I want to write about women's humor, like the use of women's humor on the internet and stuff. And this book really like crystallized a lot of my thinking about it, because I think whenever, obviously there's so much writing about like the year of the girl and like online girlhood and like 27-year-old teenagers, and like it was such a thing like last year or whatever to be this constant discourse about like, are women infantilizing themselves, and what does that infantilization look like, and what's its political utility. And I found very rarely did I find writing that like satisfyingly engaged with the fact that obviously most of that stuff was like a type of joke. And there would either be people saying like, it's a, don't you get it? It's a joke, as a way to just sort of like say it's not important. And it's like, well, it is a joke, but it's actually still important and can still be criticized as a joke. I don't know if this is making sense, but.
Of course. 100% yeah.
Is. And people were not able to have these conversations when like Marie Calloway's book was a hit, like an actual hit from an independent press. She's a fucking genius. You know, like she's weird. She's not like, not a publishing type of person, like just like that was the vocabulary or like the conceptual apparatus, the architecture of everything that you have said was like not possible in the late 2010s. And I think that strangely through phenomena like the self-infantilizing but deeply manipulative or whatever, like I don't know, influencer of making little things out of felt or whatever. I don't know, like, good for her. But it has maybe brought us to a place of different or more sophisticated understanding. I don't know, we went via them. Charlotte, what do you think?
I don't know if either of you read. Jean Garnett wrote a piece about sort of revisiting hetero fatalism, pessimism. And one thing was that people are bad readers. I don't think they're intentionally reading in bad faith. They're just not good readers. And then, of course, people are also reading in bad faith. But the inability of most of the people complaining about that to recognize when and how and where she was funny. And the secondhand embarrassment also of when people can't understand women being funny.
The outrage of Sean Fay being a big fan of Jermaine Greer. Jermaine Greer is so funny when she's talking about, like, I was thinking about, so today about, she talks about labia that look like horse, what are they called? Like horse bits, whatever. She's so funny. And no one could deal with that either.
A lot of it's really funny. A lot of Dworkin is really funny. Shulamith Firestone, so much of this stuff. And that was like, she's making a joke. And nobody knew that she was making a joke. But I think there's like this other step where like, it's frustrating because like those works are still flawed and the jokes that people make can still be flawed, but you can actually only criticize them appropriately if you recognize that they're jokes through a humor-based analysis. And I think that, I don't know if it's because some critics are pretty humorless or like what's, but I find that really lacking, where I'm like, and this book, reading After Claude, really made me think so much about like the purposes of women's humor, the way that a joke operates, like the actual, like the, I don't know, the joke as this literary object and a literary device that has its own like objectives and its motives, and how powerful it can be, how convincing it can be, how like palliative it can be, a joke, something funny.
We have to do this every week because we have barely gotten into everything we need to cover.
I feel, oh my like god, just- I Don't you think that we're, like, being tyrannized by the bad joke right now? Like, fucking sketch comedy. I have all my dating apps is like, no comedians, no comedians, no comedians. Like, the paradigms and the languages of what is supposed to be captivating or engaging, like, in the briefest amount of time is just, like, making me so depressed. I should just, like, get rid of my phone, I guess, but...
Well, Rain, have you read The Golden Notebook?
No, I haven't, and everybody tells me to read it every...
We did an episode with Jamie that'll come out, and Jamie picked The Golden Notebook because she loves it, and just thinking about, you know, women's humor and also how much it binds us to each other, and in the first scene in The Golden Notebook, it's these two really close friends who are having fun together, and also things aren't great.
Classic story of my life.
The woman's condition. Having a laugh together and things are going kind of bad. Writers is hosted and produced by Joe Livingstone and Charlotte Shane, and released in partnership with Book Forum Magazine. You can learn more about us and support the show at www.patreon.com/readingwriters. You can also write to us at readingwriterspod@gmail.com with questions, comments, and praise, or leave a review for us wherever you listen.
Profound thanks also to Martí Zolko and Joe Valley, who composed the beautiful music you're listening to now.